Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
So if I have this fear, again, we talked about fear of failure. If I have this fear of stressful activities, of anxiety, et cetera, then it's going to be debilitative. Like, my hormonal profile will shift in a negative direction, right? And why does that happen? Because the body, right? Your mind is a pretty smart thing. Your brain is a pretty remarkable thing. It thinks, okay, like, I'm getting anxious. Like, I'm about to be in a bad spot. I got to prepare for this, right? So it's the mindset. But on the other hand, if you see stress as a way to grow, as a way that your body is preparing to perform, then what happens is, yeah, you're still got a little bit of that anxiety and anxiousness, but what happens is it becomes a positive. An example I always like to give in an athletic standpoint is, think about like the best performances. Like, you don't see them at practice, right? You don't see records being broken, you know, when you're doing nothing and it's just you and your coach at practice. You see them during the big competitions, the big games, when people step up. And the reason people are able to step up is because that anxiety, that stress gives you an extra boost in performance if it lets you do it.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Doing creative work can be kind of lonely, and that's why we built the Unmistakable Listener Tribe. The Tribe is a community for professionals to connect and support each other. Everything is designed to help you grow your business and share what's working and what isn't. And that's true whether you're a business owner or an artist. You'll get access to feedback, live conversations with guests, and so much more. By joining the Tribe, you become part of a community of creators who all support each other, and it's completely free. Hopefully I'll see you there. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to join. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/tribe. Steve, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I came across your work by way of Ryan Holiday's newsletter, where he mentioned your book, Peak Performance. And as I was just saying before we hit record here, easily one of the best books on the subject of peak performance that I have come across in all the time I've been doing this research about this subject. But before we get there, I want to start by asking you, what social group were you a part of in high school, and what impact did that end up having on your life?
Oh, man. So as a high school student, I was kind of a clueless running nerd. And what I mean by that is my entire like high school career was consumed by running. So I was on the cross country and track team, right? And anything outside of that, that world just didn't exist. I mean, my dad's an orthodontist. My mom's a school teacher. So education was really big to them. I have an older brother who was one of the tops in his class in high school and college. So it was really pushed towards us. But if you ask them about me during that time period, it was all running, and everything else was just put to the wayside. I mean, it was the kind of example I like to use is I would go to bed at 9:30 or 10 o'clock at latest, regardless of what anything else was going on. And the only reason was that is because I lived in Texas and we'd have practice at 6:30 or 7 in the morning for our runs because it's always hot here. So I was infamous as a senior in high school for as the kid who would leave like the homecoming dance or the prom dance early at 10 o'clock or 9:30 because it was, oh, Steve has to go. And everybody just kind of knew that and accepted that and probably thought it was really weird, obviously. But at that time, it was just completely normal to me.
So walk me through kind of from there to sort of what else happened after that, because I know it was a really informative part of your life and kind of led you down this path of studying peak performance.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess the long story is kind of this is I was a high school running phenom. So when I entered high school and joined the cross country and track team, I was a soccer player before that. But I really took off my freshman year and ran one of the top times in the nation in the mile for a freshman that year. And I remember my high school coach pulling me aside and said, Steve, like, you can be great at this, but to be great at this, like, you have to choose. You need to stop soccer. You need to like stop doing the other stuff. And you just need to go all in essentially on this. And I was clueless. I thought, oh, great. This is awesome. Like, I'm good. Like, I can be really great at this. Mm-hmm. And that really started this journey towards trying to be as fast as I could be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it came really easy at first. And if you look at my high school career, by the time I graduated, I had run my senior year. I was the fastest high schooler in the nation. I was the third or fourth fastest under 20 runner in the world. I'd run the sixth fastest all time at that point high school mile ever. So I was really, really good. And I ran at, you know, the peak of it was probably, and we talk about this in the book a little bit, is I ran at a professional track meet called the Prefontaine Classic. And if anyone who follows track, the Pre-Classic is the largest professional meet in the country. It's one of the biggest in the world, most celebrated in the world. Like, all the top sprinters, distance runners, everybody who's in track like shows up. So I ran the mile there against, I think it was 15 or 16 other professional athletes, professional runners. And I had people in the race who were, you know, Olympic medalists, the second fastest miler of all time in history, and just some really, really phenomenal athletes. And I got thrown in there as a high schooler. And that's where I ran the fastest time that I did and beat a couple guys who were like NCAA champions and US national champions. So I finished that race, ran 4:01 for a mile. So just missed this like magic barrier of going sub 4 minutes in the mile. And I remember initially being, you know, disappointed because I came so close, and that was, you know, one of the big goals to knock off. But in my head, I remember looking up in the stadium, and you've got, you know, 20,000 people there watching you, and it's on NBC live, and the camera's on you. And in my head, I'm like, no, this is awesome. This is amazing. Like, I should appreciate this because it's only the start. Mm-hmm. And I think that is where my story really begins, in the sense that I thought, like, okay, I am here, I'm on top of the world. In my head, I'm thinking, all right, Olympics, Olympic medals, like, this is going to be my career. I'm just going to run and I don't have to worry about anything else. And that was what I wanted at that point, because my vision was so narrow that it was the only thing that mattered at that point in my life. So those were kind of the kinds of things that I were thinking. And flash forward a couple years, and my college career was a disaster, to put lightly. You know, post-collegiately, I tried to run again, tried to run really fast. And my mile best still sits as what I ran as an 18-year-old kid that summer. And it wasn't, and the thing that defined it is, it wasn't for lack of trying. It was almost because I tried too hard. And what I mean by that is, I thought, this is how I got good. So to get to the next level, I have to increase this 2x or 3x and give more effort, because I was fully bought into the almost myth that if I work hard enough, then I'm going to accomplish anything that I want to. So I just went headfirst into work, and my essential burnout from running and never accomplishing my goals and all that stuff led me into coaching, and then ultimately led into this exploration of the book, which is, is it possible to reach that level and higher levels of excellence without suffering the burnout, you know, the fatigue and all those other nasty things that can come with it?
Okay, so many questions from that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
I'm curious about the relationship with your coach, you know, because I had a very sort of similar experience with ninth grade band, where a band director in seventh grade pulled me aside and he said, "You're going to make All-State band one day." And I missed All-State band by one chair as a freshman in Texas, of all places.
Oh, wow.
And I remember being very defined by that goal for the better part of seventh, eighth, ninth grade. And, you know, apparently it was a big deal to make, you know, miss All-State by one chair as a freshman was considered an accomplishment, which I considered a massive failure. So two questions come from this. One, tell me about the relationship with your coach. What impact that ended up having on your life? What role coaches do actually play you as a coach now? And also, when you've been defined by something for so long and you don't, you know, it doesn't end up becoming the thing that becomes your life, how do you resolve that sort of loss of identity?
Yeah, those are really good questions. I mean, I guess to start with, my relationship with my coach was really good. I had a high school coach who cared. It was actually funny because he was kind of a sprints-based, so speed-based coach at first, and then he like took over the cross-country team, and it corresponded to me, who was more like a middle and long-distance runner. So he was really learning at the same time as coaching to a lot of degrees. So we were really almost on this comparable journey of trying to figure out things that worked to get me faster, and he was trying to learn how to do it. But I think that relationship to a coach can either be the greatest or the greatest experience of your life, or something that almost haunts you, depending on how it goes. In my case, I was lucky in that I had someone who cared, and I think regardless of the performance aspects, like having that person who influenced my life in a positive way and was there when things went bad and was there when I wasn't reaching my goals, taught me way more as a person than any class I ever attended, right? Or any guidance that I ever got. And I think that's, whether it's athletics, academics, music, whenever you have someone who is coaching you, what I always tell my athletes now is that I'm going to see you at your highest highs and your lowest lows, right? You can't fake the emotion that comes with missing All-State band by one place, right? Mm-hmm. You can't fake the emotion that comes with, like, you know, missing the state meet in track or whatever it is. Like, it's just raw. It's just there. Your professors, your teachers, even to some degrees, your parents in a lot of ways, like, you're going to put on a facade and you're going to hide that, right? And you're not going to let them see that this matters as much, or that this emotional expression, they're never going to see it all. But in an aspect where you're getting to see as a coach all these raw experiences, it gives this great responsibility to channel that and to make sure that athletes learn from these experiences. So I think in a lot of ways, regardless of what it is you're coaching or teaching, is your responsibility is greater than almost anyone in terms of a kid's development. So I think that's on the coaching side. And then the other question you asked there is on the loss of identity. And I think this is a subject that isn't covered enough. So no one really talks about what happens after your sport is done, or what happens after you were, you know, All-State band and then you go off to college and you're no longer able to play that instrument, or what happens when, you know, your identity gets taken away. And of everything that I've had to deal with in life, that was probably the biggest struggle, because as you probably got from my story, like, I was all in, obsessed on running through high school and through college. And when everybody identifies you as that, it becomes like your sole identity, right? Your sole purpose almost. So I'd walk around, and even if I hadn't seen, you know, a friend in 4 or 5 years, the one thing they'd remember was, "Hey, Steve, you're the runner," right? If I met new people who kind of knew who I was, "Steve the runner." And that's great when it's going really well, right? Because you're like, "Oh yeah, great. You know me, like, I'm the runner. Cool." All that's going around. but it really eats at you when it's not, right? When that identity is almost stolen from you and you no longer have this like competency to hang your hat on. And if you know anything about like psychology and that stuff, you look at self-determination theory and you look at, okay, what are these things that actually matter? What are our basic human needs? And one of those is like competency, right? And I think what happens, and what happened to me is like, I almost had this like crisis of internal story or internal narrative, right? Up until I started to perform really poorly, like my life had this like continual arc to it, right? And then once that arc is disrupted, now it's like I'm a person without a beginning, middle, and end that I can connect with, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it put me on this loss and on this search of like, okay, if I'm not a runner, or if I'm not identifying myself solely as this, like, who am I and what am I supposed to do? And for myself, as at that period of time, probably 19 to 21 year old, like, I don't think I had like the capacity or the ability to sort through that as well as I should have at that time, because it's not something that is ever talked about, ever discussed. So it led to a lot of like wrong turns, a lot of, you know, a lot of just false pressure on myself and to try and like meander through the woods blind almost and come out on the other side with some sort of identity intact. So it was it's to put it very shortly and bluntly, you know, it sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where was the turning point at which you finally let go of it? Like, was there a point at which it finally stopped having the sting that it does, or do you still feel it today?
You know, it takes a long while. And what I would say is it's never just one moment where it's like, oh, it's gone. Like, I am now this instead.
Yeah.
It's this continuum, this process, right? And over years, it's a process over years of almost like letting go of that. And more than letting go, it's like coming to terms with that. Mm-hmm. And like weaving that past identity into your current narrative and your current story, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, for me, the real kind of turning point on my journey towards figuring it out was actually like giving back. So whenever you're pursuing something, whether it's running or academics or music or art, whatever it is, whenever you're pursuing something with almost reckless abandon to try and be really good at it, it's almost inherently a selfish proposition. Like, it's very selfish of me to put running first in my life through those years. I mean, if you ask my parents and my brothers and my sister, they hate it at times because you think of it, we'd go on vacation, right? And we'd go on a road trip and, you know, we'd have to stop and I would go run 9 miles where, well, my parents, you know, filled up with gas and stuff like that. And it would annoy everybody else. But in my head, I'm thinking like, oh, this is just what I have to do. Like, I'm not going to skip a day of running because we're going on a road trip. Like, I have to get this done.
Yeah.
But it's a very selfish proposition. And I think what finally got me out of this is like to take my experience. And at first it was through like volunteer coaching and saying like, okay, here's where I went wrong, or like, here's the lessons I learned. And let's try and make sure that this next generation, these other kids, like learn from that and don't have to go through that. And I think that's whether it's from a coaching aspect or whether it's from writing now, mm-hmm. it's the rest of my life has kind of been defined of like of making sense of that, but also like figuring out, all right, here was my story, here's my way, but is there a way we can do this without going through some of the pitfalls and identity crisis that I kind of did.
So I want to talk briefly about the relationship with your parents, and I'm really glad you brought them up because, you know, a lot of parents are listening to this, and I think we live in a world that has almost an obsessive focus on peak performance and productivity. I mean, we glorify the stories of successful entrepreneurs. I mean, what do we do here at Unmistakable Creative? We take people's stories like yours and we kind of shine a spotlight on people who appear superhuman in so many ways. So for parents who are listening, what would you tell them? And, you know, like, what was this dynamic like with your parents outside of driving them crazy with these 9 mile runs?
Yeah. You know, parents have, and they know this, like, you have a great power and responsibility. It's just like, coach. But I think the flip side of it is, and what I can say now, having, you know, I've spent time coaching in the collegiate system. So I get, you know, 18 to 22 year olds who I get to work with and develop and all that stuff. And what I see is that their parents should have empathy towards their kid performing and going after something to a high degree, right? When you're looking at people who choose to go down this path, like people like you or I, or the people who listen to this podcast who are trying to be more productive, motivation most of the times isn't the issue, right? Most of the time, it's like supporting and almost holding people back from doing dumb things, right? And what I mean by that is, like, if I work with someone who's really good with a runner now, my job, even if they're trying to make the Olympics, like, my job isn't to necessarily push them forward. It's to guide them in a productive way that is sustainable and almost hold them back at certain points from doing the wrong things, mm-hmm. right? And as a parent, your job is to ingrain good behaviors, but also ingrain good mindsets. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, quite frankly, like, most of the problems that you see with high achieving students coming into college or even afterwards is a lot of their psychological stuff issues can be tied to relationships with parents. Mm-hmm. So if a parent, like, desperately wants their kid to be the best at whatever it is, what happens is, the parent is super excited. They start pushing their kid. They might even not know it. They think they're being supportive, but they're really pushing them. And that could be from signing them up for, you know, music class every single day to get extra practice, or taking them to every practice imaginable for soccer, whatever it is. Like, they think they're being supportive, but what actually happens is the kid is being sent a message that, like, oh, my parent values this. They're invested in this, and if I let them down, I'm going to feel really, really bad, right? And what happens over time is you see this cycle where the motivation in the kid shifts from, I'm doing this activity because I really like it, enjoy it, and want to be good at it, to, I'm doing this activity because I don't want to disappoint my parent. I don't want to, you know, fail because we've invested all this time, money, et cetera, into this. And once you get into that fear of failure mindset, it's a bad place to be. It's not sustainable, I think, is the number one thing. Yeah. But it also, what happens, and I see this all the time in athletes before a competition, right? So if you're lining up to do a race, you can tell the ones who, well, they're nervous because everyone's nervous. They're excited because they're getting an opportunity to do something that they enjoy to do, right? They enjoy competing, so they're doing it. And then you can see the other ones who are nervous as well, but they're nervous because their parent is sitting in the stands and they're afraid that if they perform poorly, that their parent is going to be disappointed. And then what happens is they just get scared and frightened every time they enter a competition space, because it becomes like, oh, what if I disappoint now? What if I fail? What if I, you know, if my parent puts his head down and all that stuff and can't, you know, doesn't want to talk to me afterwards? And it's just sad to see, because it's really hard to dig someone out of that. And it just gets, like, psychologically ingrained. So I think the message to parents is, it's actually a pretty simple one, is watch what pressure you're putting on them, right? And then watch what message you're delivering to them, right? It's almost like some of the mindset research that has been come out. Are you giving a message that they should feel good about competing, giving their effort, seeing how much they can get out of it? Or are you giving a message that all that matters is like winning or losing? And if you lose, like, I'm not going to be happy with you. And I think to finalize that point, so I like to say is that when you look at losing youth athletes, for instance, we don't lose athletes who might compete in their youth level and then just give up on sports and, you know, high school and beyond. We don't lose them out at practice or out in the games. What happens is most of the time we lose them on the car ride home. So it's the parent who, you know, thinks he's doing a good job by saying like, oh, you know, hey, Jimmy, like, you should have done this, 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 and this, and this, right? And if you would have done this, you would have performed better. Well, all the kid is getting is like, oh man, I disappointed my parent. Like, I didn't, you know, they don't approve of what I did. I screwed up, et cetera, et cetera. Am I saying not to ever critique them? No, I'm not saying that. Like, that's how you get better, right? But I'm saying there's a time and there's a place and there's a way to do it. And a lot of times what happens is we send that message when they're at their lowest low, like after a loss or after a poor performance. And if you look at the research, actually, there's some really interesting studies that I've looked at rugby players. And they looked at delivering what message is delivered after a loss, like after a game loss. And if it's, hey, let's go through all the mistakes right after and, you know, critique you so that we can correct them next time. Or is it, hey, like, that's all right. Like, let's pump you back up. If the coaches or parents went through the mistakes and critiqued, what happens is in male rugby players, their testosterone levels actually drop, like in that moment. They decrease. And their cortisol levels, their stress hormones, actually go up. And what happens is that that ratio of stress hormones to testosterone, which testosterone is kind of a, you know, a buildup anabolic hormone, what happens is the body's in a really bad space to recover and also learn and adapt when you're looking at those things. And what they actually did is they tied it where they could predict how a player would perform based on that change several games later or several days later in the next game. So those who got a critique and like a you know, your kind of high school football, you know, screaming at them, testosterone levels dropped, and then 2 days later at the next rugby game, they played horrible. Those who kind of got brought back up, testosterone levels increase, positive stuff. 2 days later, they play a better game. And I think, well, that's, you know, a simple study and example. I think the same thing holds true with, you know, parents talking to their kids and what message they send.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Wow. Well, let's do this. You've mentioned the word sustainable multiple times over the course of our conversation, which is what I know that the entire content of this book about is sustaining peak performance. So can you give us an overview of sort of all the chapters and each component of it and how we sustain peak performance in our lives, regardless of what the, you know, thing that we're doing is, whether it's art, whether it's music, whether it's something athletic?
Sure, definitely. So what we did is we set out and we looked and said, okay, from my story, how can we do this sustainable? So we went through, dug through the research, dug through performers at the highest level in multiple domains and tried to see what everyone did. And we kind of distilled those into a couple commonalities. And I think what those were is the first one we called the growth equation. And what that means is the growth equation to us is stress plus rest equals growth. So regardless of what we're trying to get better at, we need to apply some sort of stress. We need to struggle with it. And by stress, I mean like not like anxiety necessarily. I mean, let's train. Let's do something with effort. Let's struggle with it. But the flip side of that is we need rest to get better. So stress plus rest equals growth. If we don't have that rest component, we don't adapt and we don't get better. And that's where I think a lot of people miss out on, is that we really emphasize the effort, the work, the productivity part, but we don't emphasize the flip side, which I didn't do as a runner, is give yourself enough space to let that sink in. Like let that physical work adapt, right? We don't get better when we lift weights. We get better when the muscle repairs after we've lifted weights. And the same thing holds true with mental activities, right? The brain doesn't get better while we're doing the math homework, for example. It gets better when we go to sleep. The brain kind of connects and does all its magical things and solidifies it into long-term memory, right? So that's number one, is that relationship with stress and rest. And then the second section we looked at, we called priming. And what this is really about is like optimizing your routine. And for each individual that we talked to, they all kind of had a routine to get them in a state to perform. And what was interesting about it is that the routines themselves, like there wasn't much commonality really. There were some, you know, standard things. But what we learned is it's not about some magical routine like you hear in a lot of places. What this is about is like owning the pattern, the habits to get you in the right space. So if I'm a writer, like what gets me in the right space to go, you know, knock out 5,000 words, whatever it is. And that routine is going to be different. Or what is the routine I get ready for a race or a performance out on the stage with musicians? Like, make sure that you are intentionally putting yourself in a place to perform. And then the last part, which was one of the most interesting, is that almost all great performers we talk to, all the research pouring into, to really get the most out of yourself, you have to have a purpose. And it's not like those kind of like cliche core values that you might see in like, you know, business-esque speak. It's instead something that really drives and really means something to you. So it's actually really got to matter, right? And what happens is if you have this purpose, this self-transcending purpose, you can reach levels of performance that just aren't capable when the motivation is something lower, like, you know, money or fame or just, you know, to benefit yourself.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit more about the stress idea, because I love the idea of stress plus rest equals growth. And yet this is so counter to the way that we actually work in the world today, right? You know, I had an idea for a blog post based on reading your book titled Why the Human Brain Was Not Designed to Work 8 Hours a Day, yet that's the standard structure in corporate America. So I want to ask you about two questions. One is, how do you prevent stress from becoming debilitating and turning into anxiety? And two, you know, let's talk about, you know, rest in a bit more detail. Like, you know, it's funny to ask a question like this, but how do people rest effectively?
Yeah, well, those are good questions. And it's things I struggle with, too, because like we're constrained by our society. Right. And you're right. Like we weren't meant to work for, you know, 8 hour days, just go grind away and then stop. And, you know, it's interesting. I won't bore you with the details too much, but you can trace the history of this almost to like the industrialization of and like the Henry Ford Model T version of work. Right. Because it's like, oh, this is how we get the most out of everybody productivity wise on the assembly line. But for performance wise and for activities that are more, you know, even physical, but all more mentally demanding like we have now and like our knowledge economy, it just makes zero sense, yet we still do it. So I think, you know, your first question was like, how do you deal with this stress and not turn it into anxiety? And I think there it comes back to what the research says on mindsets, right? So there's some really good work out there that shows up. How you appraise stress determines whether it's beneficial or negative, right? So if I have this fear, again, we talked about fear of failure. If I have this fear of stressful activities, of anxiety, et cetera, then it's going to be debilitative. Like my hormonal profile will shift in a negative direction, right? And why does that happen? Because the body, right? Your mind is a pretty smart thing. Your brain is a pretty remarkable thing. It thinks, okay, like I'm getting anxious, like I'm about to be in a bad spot. I got to prepare for this, right? So it's the mindset. But on the other hand, if you see stress as a way to grow, as a way that your body is preparing to perform, then what happens is, yeah, you're still got a little bit of that anxiety and anxiousness, but what happens is it becomes a positive. An example I always like to give in an athletic standpoint is think about like the best performances. Like you don't see them at practice, right? You don't see records being broken, you know, when you're doing nothing and it's just you and your coach at practice. You see them during the big competitions, the big games when people step up. And the reason people are able to step up is because that anxiety, that stress gives you an extra boost in performance if it lets you do it. So what I always preach is this mindset shift is, it's not anxiety. It's not those jitters that you're feeling aren't a negative. They are a positive in the sense that your body is telling you, hey, we're preparing for battle, or we're preparing to perform, or we're preparing to give our best on this speech in front of 1,000 people that you're going to do. Like we need to release these hormones, this adrenaline to get you ready, because if we have more adrenaline, like your body and your mind is going to perform at a higher level. It's almost like our own little, our body's almost giving us our own little shot of coffee beforehand, like shot of espresso, right? It's saying like, all right, this might make you feel a little jittery, but it's going to help you stay awake and focused and ready to go. So take your shot of espresso. And that's what our body is doing on a chemical standpoint. So it's really about that mindset. And I think the other thing that is really interesting and tying to that is that oftentimes, as coaches, teachers, you know, friends, we often give the wrong advice to people who are about to perform, right? So if I go up and you're about to go on stage and give a talk, if I say, hey, it's all right, man, just relax, just stay relaxed. What I'm doing, and the research backs this up, is by saying relax, the other person, like in their head, they get, oh, he's telling me to relax because A, stress and anxiety is a negative thing, so I should try to push that away. And B, he's telling me I should relax because I must look anxious. I must not look confident. So you're sending almost this like subconscious internal negative message. So the message you send in instead is that of excitement. Is like, hey, you know, you've trained, you prepared for this. Like, you should be excited. You're ready to go, you know. All those positive things, right? And then on the other question you asked on rest is how do people rest? Is I think it seems like such a simple thing that and because of that we never put too much thought into it, right? Mm-hmm. So rest, people think like, oh, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna turn the TV on, I'm just gonna sit there and maybe flip through Twitter on my phone or scroll through Facebook on my computer, and that's my rest, like I'm turning off. Well, the reality is that's not really recovery, right? Because your mind is still engaged, and if you're on Twitter or Facebook, you're getting like all these dopamine hits of seeing all the likes you got or the hearts or whatever it is now. So your brain is engaged and it's not recovering. Like rest to us is taking both a mental and a physical break. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people only think of the physical standpoint. So if you look at the research, like what really works well, you know, not surprisingly, is like going for a walk in nature or even just going for a walk. Like going for a walk will switch some of those hormonal profiles we talked about in terms of cortisol and testosterone. You know, doing things like that, doing things like reading a book or something where it's like you're letting your body and your mind come down and off of whatever stressful thing you were working on is what we need to look at. And it's not the take my mind on this mindless journey of perusing YouTube and the internet, right? It's actively recovering and doing stuff like that. And the last one I'll mention is that being social and being around friends is incredibly, incredibly helpful in terms of rest and recovery. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I talked to a coach who is a coach of a professional sports team in the U.S. And he said, what we did post game is we switched from having our players get their meals on the bus or on the plane. And if we did that, they'd be on their phone and they'd just be eating their meal by themselves on their phone. And what we did is we switched it to like a team gathering, right? So phones were away and we're just having a good time, decompressing, talking about things. And they measured, again, I'm going to come back to those hormonal profiles, and you saw increased testosterone, decreased cortisol, better gameplay next time. Right? Because you gave people this social environment to kind of decompress, go through their game a little bit in a non-threatening way. So, you know, we said it in our book, but I think like happy hour can be great as long as you're doing it as like leave the work away. Don't go to happy hour and have a bad time discussing all the office politics. Like get social, enjoy the conversation, and that's a great form of recovery.
I love that. Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the devices piece because I think it's such an important part of how you recover in the world today. And we really, it's almost maddening how problematic it is.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? I mean, and I'm as guilty as anybody, right? Sure. I have to actively think about it. And I think the thing we have to realize with our devices is, you know, they're designed by really smart people, PhDs and the like, to keep us engaged, right? That's what they're designed to do. Yeah. Like they want engagement. So like I'm going to lose that battle, right? Because, you know, I'm just going to mindlessly go through it. So you got to design your day. You got to, you know, almost foolproof things to be like, all right, you know, device over here, it's away from me during these times. Like, it shouldn't be there, because it is. It just leaves you drained and unproductive.
So let's do this. I want to talk briefly about routine, and I want to focus on one specific area of routine. You know, you guys did a lot of emphasis on environment and the role that it plays in routine, and I'd love for you to expand on that, and then we'll wrap it up by talking about purpose and transcendence.
Sounds good to me. Yeah. So the role the environment plays in routine is something that I think isn't as well understood and isn't as well publicized as some of the other core concepts of routine, because it's been done to death a little bit. What we found is there's this branch of psychology called ecological psychology that looks at how humans interact with their environment. Right. And what they found through a couple different research and theories is that, like, how you set up your environment can almost invite you to do actions. Right. So it's almost like creating a habit, but not quite. So if I'm going to write and I say, all right, I'm going to write and I'm going to do it every day at this time, and I'm going to set this desk over here, and on the desk is going to be, you know, my coffee mug or whatever it is, my pen, and it's going to have this, and it's going to have this chair, and that desk is only going to be for writing. What happens is, in the brain, right, if I walk over and walk near that desk and, like, just take a look at it, the areas in my brain get us ready for, like, writing, right? Maybe areas related to, you know, using my hands or whatever have you. They'll start to light up in anticipation of that, almost as if it's like calling me, inviting me to do that. Because if I just, it's tied to that activity. So, because the brain, what happens is the brain prepares before the action has taken place. So if I go and I'm trying to shoot hoops, like, before I take the shot, my brain has almost lit up in its head, like, the muscle program to shoot a basket, right? Because it can't do it all after the fact. It has to be anticipatory. So what happens is, we can take advantage of that and really set up our environment so that it calls us to be productive. Because what the reality is, most of us right now set up our homes and to call us to be unproductive, right? Because think about it. What is the center of most people's living rooms or houses? Like, the big TV, right? Yeah. It's, and the couch, the nice comfy couch. And there's a reason we all go to it after work or after we're tired and we're fatigued. Like, we just get called to it. And it's not necessarily really our fault. It's just, like, that's the way the environment draws our brain to it. So what we suggest a lot in the book is to rearrange that outcome, right? So set your environment up to call you towards being productive, right? To make it easy so that your brain says, oh, I normally write there, I'm going to go that. Or for my case, like, you know, now that I still run a little bit to stay in shape and try and get it in, get in the work around all the work that I do, maybe it's like, hey, my running shoes are going to be at the foot of my door. Or in other cases, if I know I want to exercise when I come home, what I do is I put my shoes and, you know, my exercise clothes, whatever it is, in the passenger seat of my car, so that when I get in work, I'm like, oh man, I should really go to the park and go for a run or go to a gym, right? And get some sort of workout in. I'm rigging my environment to work for me, not against me. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that we can take away.
Well, let's wrap it up by talking about this idea of purpose and transcendence. You know, I mean, I think we talk a lot about that, and it's kind of a nebulous concept. And, you know, I always wonder, like, how do you find this? To me, it's one of those things I feel that I found through years of trial and error. There wasn't some sort of, hey, here's the formula for finding your purpose.
Yeah. You know, everybody wants, like, the one answer, right?
Yeah.
And it's funny. I was talking talking to a couple athletes I coach earlier in the day, and they were talking about like love and passion in terms of like, oh, is there one love for everyone? Is there one passion for everyone? And I think the same thing can be said about like purpose. Is there like one purpose, and we're on this mythical journey to go find what it is our purpose in life? And I think when we look at it in that sense, what happens is we're kind of limiting ourselves. And instead, we should take a mindset of like, all right, purpose comes from a good fit and an ability to develop it, right? And how am I going to find that? Then I have to explore my interests. And there might be things that like, oh, this is really interesting to me. And it might never be like a passion. But if I explore enough interests, like eventually I'm going to get to something that I am going to be passionate about, and then I can develop into a greater and greater passion. And I think the same goes to when you're looking at purpose. And the way we kind of delineated it in the book is to really sit down and go through an exercise of deciding what actually matters to you, right? What are the core things that means something in life that I seem to care about? What are the things that really interest me that, you know, I would do in my off time, I would do for free, et cetera, et cetera? What are those things that I'm really drawn to? And then really have a kind of evaluation, almost like dig and excavate why these things matter to you. And in the book, we kind of go through this process a little bit more of like developing a purpose statement and all those things to remind you. But I think the simplistic version of it is like, you got to find something that when the going gets tough, when you're really fatigued, when, you know, you don't want to do the overtime at work and you really just want to go home and quit, it's something that you can turn to that says, man, this is why I'm doing this, or this is what it is. You know, we talked to we mentioned him in the book, but not in this realm. We talked to a drummer named Matt Billingsley, who's been a drummer, a professional drummer for some of the biggest acts, music acts in the industry. And I was sitting there talking to him, and I said, hey, like, when you're in the middle of a drum set and you're playing in front of 50,000 people, and what happens is like you screw up, right? You miss a hit, miss a beat, whatever it is. Like, how do you get reengaged? Or maybe you're really tired and you just keep missing things, and like you're just thinking like, I'm not going to get through this set. Like, how do you make it through? And he says, well, now it's pretty simple. Like, I sit there and say, all right, why am I doing this? My kids. Like, my kids is my purpose at this point. Like, I am doing this to provide for them in a financial sense, but also to set this example of like, hey, if you want to be good at things, if you want to, you know, reach your goals, like, you can do it. And really turn to that thing that matters. And for him, it was his children. And for others, it can be other things, right? Mm. So it's really about finding that thing that you can turn to in the down times.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been amazing. Really. I mean, you've packed it with a ton of valuable insight. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, that's, you know, I knew this question was coming and I still don't have a good answer. I would say it's a couple of things. I think unmistakable people, people who have that quality, is they have a curiosity about themselves to push further, to understand deeper. And it's a natural curiosity. It's something that, yes, they've developed, but it's something that is pure and genuine, right? It's the people who I remember having conversations with 10 years down the road who made an impact on me are the people who are like just so into it, who just had this need to understand, to pursue their mastery of their craft to a high degree, that it just like inspired me, right? Where I was saying like, you know, I know nothing about, I don't know, sushi making, right? But this guy I know, like, that was his craft, and I could sit there and I could listen to him for hours talking about something that I have zero idea and really zero interest about. But that passion, that curiosity, that drive to understand what it is at a very deep level, I think that's what makes someone unmistakable.
Awesome. Well, this has been phenomenal. Where can people learn more about you, your work, and the book?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Magness. That's M-A-G-N-E-S-S. And my own personal blog is Science of Running for running stuff. And then our book website is peakperformancebook.net. I think. And it can be found any bookstore you want.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys and download your free copy.